Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. This is Internet Talk Radio coming to you from Sweden, Scandinavia. You can find us online at redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. Today we have Ian R. Crane with us. He was one of the speakers at the Beyond Knowledge conference in Liverpool. And we did not have time to have Ian on the show before the conference took place. I saw segments of his talk at the conference and really wanted to have him on the program since then. Ian sent us three DVDs the other day, one on peak oil, one on Codex Alimentarius, and another one called Fool Me Once that goes into the New World Order and much more. And Ian has some really important and interesting perspectives that we're going to discuss here today. Codex Alimentarius is one of the topics that we have been talking about during some of our recent programs. We have mentioned it, but not really kind of dived into it. And this is one of the main areas that Ian gives talks about. So I think it's a good idea to begin on this note here today. Ian has a couple of websites that you can take a look at. ianrcrane.co.uk. Also foolmeonce.co.uk. He also has a blog that can be found at foodcode.blogspot.com. That's a good resource for more information on Codex Alimentarius. Okay, so let's say hi to our guests. It's good to have you on the program, Ian, and thank you very much for coming on.
Hi, Henrik. Thanks for the invitation. Much appreciated.
Yeah, it's very, very good to have you here, and I watch your three DVDs basically in a row, and there's much information to dive into today, of course, but I'd like to ask you at the beginning here how long you've been doing talks and researching the topics like the New World Order and even Codex Alimentarius.
Oh, that's a very good question, good place to start, obviously. Actually, my background is in the oil field industry. And I spent 20 years in the oilfield services industry working with a company called Schlumberger. And during the time that I was with Schlumberger, I had the opportunity to live and work in the UK, obviously, in mainland Europe, in the Middle East, and in North America, and certainly to travel extensively outside those areas. And you know, perhaps just to sort of give a little bit of background as to how I got into this subject, I actually have to go back to 1991 when I was based in the Middle East, and I was one of the first people to go into Kuwait at the end of the first Gulf War. And I was traveling around southern Kuwait with one of my colleagues and you know, with a guy from the American military. And you know, we were taking a look at the logistics that were going to be involved in doing the firefighting exercise. Well, as we were touring around the southern Kuwait oil fields, it really became quite apparent to me that the official version of events was not actually supported by the physical evidence, i.e. what I was witnessing firsthand. And to put it in a nutshell, what occurred to me was that the oil fires in Kuwait at the end of the Gulf War were not actually set alight by the retreating Iraqi troops. They were set alight by the American special forces. And this obviously was totally contrary to what everybody in the world was being told.
Yeah.
And it was actually my first experience at the ripe old age of 34. It was my very first experience of, you know, if you like, something hitting me between the eyes and telling me that, you know, the official version of events might not always be the truth.
Yeah.
And it took me a number of years before I sort of integrated that, and I started to do a lot of research into history, you know, reading a lot of alternative history, and obviously completely revisiting my worldview. Well, I finally left the oil industry in 1998, and really started to do a lot of research into mythology, into cosmology, and into the deep geopolitics, and with a particular interest in the occult agendas that are contained within the geopolitical agenda, within the more overt political agendas. And then, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, when 9/11 went down, you know, I must say it took a few months before I was completely convinced, but eventually I knew beyond any reasonable doubt, and based on analysis of the physical evidence, that what occurred on 9/11 was certainly not what was being presented as the official version of events.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really the trigger for me. And so since then, I've been effectively a full-time researcher into deep geopolitics. And I've been giving presentations on a whole range of subjects based around my research for the last 4 years now.
Mm, excellent. Yeah, you're very eclectic, as it were, and I like that a lot about you, that you kind of focus on many different areas. And I want to go back. We don't have to spend that much time on this, at least here at the beginning, because we do want to get into the Codex aspect. But going back to the first Gulf War, how did you find out that it actually was the U.S. side that set these oil field fires?
Well, what was the physical evidence? The physical evidence was actually the dead Iraqis that were around many of the wellheads. And it was quite evident to me that the Iraqi troops had actually been defending the wellheads against the advancing American troops and against the American Special Forces.
Hmm.
And you know, as if to endorse my view, a few days later, I was it was about 2 weeks later, when I was back up in Iraq, in Kuwait rather, and I was sitting having dinner. And this, you know, 400-pound gorilla in American battle fatigues walked over to the table where I was eating. And he said, are you Ian Crane? And before I could answer, he just said, I've been hearing that you've been casting some aspersion as to who set them wells alight.
Uh-huh.
And again, before I could answer, he just said, that's the kind of thinking that can get you into a whole world of trouble, boy.
Oops.
And I remember that, you know, so clearly, you know, it was sort of indelibly... printed on my brain.
Yeah.
You know, the reference to me as the boy, and he was probably about 2 or 3 years younger than me. But you know, then he just turned to walk away, and then as he walked away, he turned back to me and he just said, what the fuck's the matter, Ian? Aren't we paying you enough?
Hmm.
And you know what, Henrik, it took me until 2003 before I actually found any corroborating evidence of my hypothesis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in 2003, I came across some articles that had been written by ex-Special Forces personnel, and where they admitted and acknowledged that they had actually been responsible for setting the wells alight.
Mm-hmm.
But it just goes to show you that, of course, to the vast majority of people, you know, the observations I've just made are complete heresy.
Yeah.
But I mean, what it demonstrated to me is how easily it is for people to be manipulated by, you know, the media. And, you know, and whatever the official version of events, i.e. that's the version that is obviously told to the media, that's the version the media puts out, and that becomes the received wisdom. And
yeah.
Quite often, you know, the received wisdom is very, very different from the reality.
Absolutely right. And no one knows and no one asks the questions. That's the most
exactly.
important thing, you know, and many people are too gullible, as it were. They really trust that, you know, everyone is out for the best intentions all the time, you know, and that's
where
the
way we are conditioned. Of course, this
yeah.
is part of a big part of, you know, the state education system.
Yeah.
And that is to instill in people this sort of inherent comfort and confidence in their rulers. In their governments.
Yeah.
And so consequently, you know, this trust is, and I was the same. I mean, there's no question. I had no reason to cause me to doubt the integrity of the various governments. And it was this singular event that actually sort of was my moment of metanoia, if you like. And it you know, I wasn't prepared to just completely dismiss my worldview on that, that one piece of evidence.
Right.
But, you know, as I researched and I dug up, you know, many books that have been suppressed or authors that have been demonized. And the bottom line is, the one thing I've learned is that if an author is demonized, you better read them. Because they have definitely got something important to say.
That's interesting. And also, as you said, I guess that 9/11 then really nailed it for you, as it were.
Oh, 9/11, I mean, is a classic. I mean, you know, I don't think we're too far away now from, you know, it almost becoming mainstream that 9/11 was an inside job.
Mm.
You know, I mean, just a couple of the incredible things that occurred that day. I mean, it's the only day in history that buildings have collapsed, you know, through fire. Now, of course, two of the buildings, World Trade Centers number 1 and 2, did actually have planes go into them. But, you know, those buildings collapsed, you know, one in less than an hour and the other one in just over an hour.
Mm.
But, of course, the thing that, you know, really caps it is that very, very few people are still aware that there was a third building, World Trade Center 7, that collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon, and that had certainly not had a plane crash into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and the other
right.
thing is, of course, that, you know, four planes were supposedly involved in the events of that day, and yet, you know, the wreckage that has been photographed doesn't even, from all four sites, wouldn't even begin to make up one single plane.
That's
right. You know, I mean, basically, if people really take a look at, you know, the many, many photographs and film footage that is available, then they would see for themselves that the physical evidence does not support the official version of events. But these guys know. I mean, they're very, very good at what they do. They're very good at creating the propaganda. So, you know, that actually they create a story. And even though the pictures don't match the story, the vast majority of people will just take the story at face value.
Absolutely. And let's dive into this a little bit more later on, perhaps in the second segment, even the guys that are potentially behind this and how this connects with the New World Order. But
sure.
for right now here, let's go into this aspect about Codex Alimentarius, because as I mentioned, we've kind of, I guess, in a way, glossed over this for the recent couple of shows here. And I really kind of want to get to the heart of the matter, as it were, here. So if you will, Ian, tell us a little bit of background on the Codex Alimentarius issue for us.
Well, first of all, Henrik, I mean, I've got to say that, you know, I hope at the mention of the phrase Codex Alimentarius, your listeners don't switch off. Because it's not exactly a phrase that rolls off the tongue.
Right.
And this is very, very deliberate. In fact, there's a document that's been produced by the National Health Federation, which is an organization that's based in the U.S., which looks after the interests of the complementary natural health community. And the headline on this document is, "Never heard of Codex? That's exactly what they want."
Hmm.
And so because, you know, the phrase is foreign, literally, to most people, then it just goes straight over the tops of most people's heads.
Yeah.
Well, of course, Codex Alimentarius simply means food code, yeah, which is why my blogspot is simply called foodcode.blogspot.com.
You got it, yeah.
And it was the Codex Alimentarius Commission was originally set up in the early 1960s. And I mean, I'm prepared to give it the benefit of the doubt and suggest that when the Codex Alimentarius Commission was first established, you know, there were some benign intentions behind it. But basically, over the last 40 years, the whole Codex Alimentarius agenda has been hijacked by the corporations, and ostensibly by the major food corporations, and not least those most interested in genetically modified foods, and the pharmaceutical industry.
So is you're mentioning the big companies are behind this. I mean, can we bung in Monsanto in there?
Monsanto, you know? Are prime movers.
Yeah.
I mean, let's you know, summarize some of the core objectives of Codex Alimentarius.
Right.
I mean, first and foremost, the objective is literally to eradicate all organic and natural farming. And that sounds, of course, that sounds outrageous. It's meant to be outrageous. It's meant to sound so outrageous that nobody will ever believe that they will do it. But, you know, let's have a look at some of the evidence again. And how many people, and I tell you, it's not very many, but how many people do you think are aware that in 2004, the US government forced the fledgling Iraqi government, of course it wasn't really a government, it was just sort of a number of appointees who the US were identifying as the Iraqi government, but they forced them to sign legislation which effectively prohibited all Iraqi farmers from saving their seeds.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, this is Mesopotamia. This is the cradle of civilization.
Hmm.
You know, this is the area where, as far as we're aware from recorded history, agriculture effectively, you know, emerged and enabled us to start the process of civilization. And here we are effectively destroying that whole ethos of self-sufficiency, you know, by putting legislation in place that demands that the farmers destroy any seeds that they do happen to save,
mm-hmm.
and that they are therefore forced to, by law now, to buy their seeds from Monsanto. And of course, the seeds that they are buying all contain the suicide gene, which means that there are no seeds to save. So consequently, a nation becomes totally dependent upon the corporatocracy.
Yeah.
I mean, this is completely outrageous. And if they'd have tried to do it anywhere else in the world, of course, it would have attracted some media attention on some level. But in Iraq, where effectively the U.S. controls the outflow of news via their embedded journalists, very, very few people are even aware that this has occurred. And this is a trial. This is a test. I mean, in the U.S., Monsanto have been deliberately sowing seeds in farms in the west of the country. Actually, this is in the U.S. and in Canada. And the reason they sow them in the west is obviously because they know the winds will blow from west to east. So the GM crops, will contaminate the organic farms that are further to the east.
Hmm.
And, what Monsanto have been doing, and this is very well documented, and there's a wonderful documentary called The Future of Food, which actually looks at this case, where Monsanto was actually suing farmers where the wind had blown the seeds across onto their farms, and they were suing the farmers for illegally growing the GM crops because they hadn't got permission from Monsanto.
This is Percy's.
I mean, this is absurd.
Yeah.
And Monsanto knew that they wouldn't ultimately win the case, but that wasn't really the point. The point was to effectively bankrupt the farmers.
Yeah.
And bring the farmers effectively under their control, because once the other farmers saw what was happening to the farmers that they were suing, they would just sort of meekly bow over to Monsanto and buy the license to plant the genetically modified crops.
Hmm. And this is the case of Percy Schmeisser that you're referring to here, isn't it?
Exactly. That's exactly correct.
Yeah. Hmm. This is incredible. And another aspect to this, of course, is for those who are meat eaters, the growth hormone issue to all of this. I mean, this is not only about all the veggies out there. This is something that's going to affect the meat, isn't that right too?
Absolutely. And very, very few people in Europe are aware that the European Union is currently paying $150 million a year in fines to the World Trade Organization because the EU refuses to import beef that has been contaminated with the recumbent growth hormone.
Hmm.
So it's the recumbent beef growth hormone, RBGH.
Yeah.
And the reason that the Europe doesn't import it is not that it never has any intention of importing it, it's just that the time isn't right. So in other words, the PR machine hasn't yet reached a point in Europe where they feel that the people will accept this contaminated beef without sort of some kind of uprising. So the EU determined that we'll continue to resist and we'll pay the fine, but that fine increases each year. And this recumbent growth hormone is very pernicious. And let me give you an example. I mean, in the course of my time in the oil field, I lived in Texas. I lived in Houston, Texas. And, there's a slogan in Texas that says everything's bigger in Texas.
Right.
Well, you got to believe it. I mean, when I lived there, the size of the people there, it's enormous. They're enormous. I mean, there is obesity in Texas like you haven't seen anywhere else in the world.
Mm.
And, call it a coincidence, but, of course, Texas is a major cattle state.
Right.
Beef is effectively the national food. The beef restaurants, steak restaurants, wherever you go all around Texas.
Right.
And the growth hormone is used as a standard in Texas.
Hmm.
And it clearly the evidence would suggest that it's not stopping in the beef, in the cattle. It's actually carried through in the meat, and it's carrying through into the people that are consuming it.
Yeah.
And, so certainly that was a trigger for me. And I stopped eating the beef while I was in Texas.
Mm.
So, yes, it impacts very much on the beef. Another area where it's impacting, of course, is in cloned meat.
Yeah, tell us about
UK,
that.
And in the UK recently, the decision was taken. Again, this is outrageous. The decision was taken that it is legitimate for farmers to sell cloned meat without actually declaring it that it was cloned. And this is ultimately how organic meat will effectively be removed from the shelves, because what will happen is ultimately the objective is to remove the requirement for labelling. Now, we have to be very, very careful with this observation about removing the requirement for labelling, because food that is grown, you know, in organic farms, in small holdings, you wouldn't expect to be labelled, would you? It's going to be in boxes, it's still going to have the dirt on it, you know, it's natural food.
Right.
The stuff that's sold in the supermarkets, obviously, there is a requirement for it to be labelled. Now, you know, so there's one side of, I mean, there's actually a slogan in the US that the campaigners use, which is, you know, effectively, you know, only buy unlabeled food.
Right.
But this is potentially dangerous.
Yeah, of course.
Because the whole objective is ultimately to remove the labeling requirements so that the consumer has absolutely no idea what they're buying.
This is about also a kind of international standardization of food, isn't that right?
Exactly. I mean, you know, Codex Alimentarius is global legislation. The Codex Alimentarius committees, of which there are 27, all addressing different issues, but these 27 committees are spread out all over the world, and I mean, effectively, what they're establishing is the template for global law. And in 1994. The Codex Alimentarius Commission was very, very close to implementing the type of legislation we're talking about in the US. And they got really right to the 11th hour when there's a chain of stores called Whole Food Stores. And Whole Food Stores realized, you know, what was about to occur. And they picked up the challenge. And Whole Food Stores, because it was sort of spread across the US and they had stores in all the major cities, they were able to mobilize, you know, their customers, and millions of people hit the streets, and they had millions of people writing to their elected representatives. And of course, the elected representatives realized that, you know, there was you know, very serious awareness of these issues by the population, and if they didn't do something about it, basically they weren't going to get reelected.
Yeah.
And so in 1994, a piece of legislation was introduced, which is called the DSHEA legislation, which stands for Dietary Supplement Health Education Act. And it was through this legislation that it effectively put a ring fence around the US food and drug law. But then what happened was the Codex Alimentarius Commission simply turned its attention to Europe. And basically, for the past sort of 12 years, it's been working, you know, behind the scenes and, you know, using sort of its tentacles throughout the EU to implement this legislation in Europe. And their thinking is that the various countries in Europe don't talk to each other, so they can actually introduce this legislation through the back door. And here we are now. I mean, we're literally at the same stage as the US was in 1993, because the game plan is to introduce this legislation with effect from December 31st, 2009. So basically, we have 18 months to try and raise the awareness throughout the European Union of what is going on here. Now, it means that we have to address it wholesale, because there's no point in the British people, for example, raising it with their elected members of parliament, because the British government has completely washed its hands of this legislation. And the British government has basically said, as have most of the other European governments, that they will do whatever it is they're instructed to do by the EU. So this is complete abdication.
Yeah.
So it really is now, you know, in the hands of the population, you know, to try and change this. Otherwise, basically, come 2010, the whole of the food industry and the natural medicines industry will have changed throughout the whole of the EU.
And this is very worrying, considering some of the stuff that is in here in the Codex Alimentarius. And I mean, what do you think would happen if this actually comes into effect? I mean, what we can see already is a kind of a, what I at least consider to be an artificially created kind of food crisis. But it's almost like they're preparing us and getting us into the mindset of this already. What's your take on this?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, there's no question. In fact, Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister has already given us more than enough evidence that the current food crisis is a deliberate manipulation to create the opportunity for the various governments to present to the people that, you know, the only way out of this is GM crops.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, as I'm sure, you know, your listeners are very aware, everything that's occurring is interconnected.
Yeah.
You know, the current phenomenal and ridiculous manipulation of oil prices is linked directly, you know, to the same issue here as with food.
Yeah.
As is the whole issue of the supposed requirement to be moving towards biofuels. You know, because, you know, in a food shortage, you know, how ridiculous can it be that instead of growing food, we're going to grow crops that can be turned into biofuels?
Yeah.
It's just completely outrageous.
Yeah. Sheesh, my God.
So the whole thing is being engineered to sort of create the perception that the only saviour here is to accept GM crops that can grow, you know, three or four crops a year.
Mm.
But you know, the real issue here is that the GM crops are completely devoid of the fundamental nutrients, minerals and vitamins that we need to be healthy.
Mm.
So the reality is that, you know, already our diet is being attacked, you know, by the use of herbicides, of pesticides. I mean, crops that are being developed. I mean, you know, I'm sure some of your listeners will have heard of Roundup Ready crops.
Mm, yeah, we're talking
you know,
about
I mean,
that.
These
yeah.
are crops that basically don't even germinate unless Roundup, which is a pesticide, is poured on them.
And even I think even the plants themselves are actually referred to as a pesticide or insecticide, you know. They're classified
exactly.
as such, you know. And they we know that the animals won't touch it, you know. They won't even bother to eat it, but they're giving it to us humans, you know. No problem.
Well, you know, this is the great irony, Heinrich, that farmers will not feed this stuff to the animals. I mean, you're right, their animals won't touch it. But they won't feed this stuff to the animals, because if they feed this stuff to the animals, guess what? The animals get sick.
Yeah.
You know, and to a farmer, the animals are his livelihood. So, you know, he needs his animals to be in the best possible health. So, you know, there is no question. We are today treating our livestock better than we're treating, you know, our fellow humans. But, you know, there's a very, very important agenda here, because you know, as people become less healthy because the diet is suffering, and I mean, we won't even get into the area of vaccinations and all that stuff, but there is a pernicious attack on the total well-being of the human being.
Yeah.
And then, of course, who rise to the rescue? Big Pharma.
Yep.
With a PH.
Hmm.
Yep. So we've got the pharmaceutical companies who in 2002... And I'm using that year because that's the year before the invasion of Iraq, when the oil companies got in on the act.
Mm-hmm.
But in 2002, the top 10 pharmaceutical companies, the profitability of those companies, was greater than the combined profitability of the other 490 companies in the Fortune 500.
Hmm.
So the pharmaceutical industry is a major, major player. I mean, it has been, I mean, since the, obviously, Second World War, when IG Farben was one of the major supporters of Hitler and his National Socialists.
Right.
And, you know, today, you know, we have a situation where, you know, the big pharmaceutical companies effectively finance whomever it is that they want to put into power. And, of course, whoever it is they put into power is then expected to support their industries.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example of how those industries are supported. I mean, one classic example is Tamiflu, which is supposedly the antidote to bird flu.
Right.
Although even the documentation of Tamiflu says that all it does is suppress the symptoms for 12 hours.
Hmm.
But Tamiflu was developed by a company called Gilead Pharmaceutical.
Mm-hmm.
And if, believe it or not, Gilead Pharmaceutical was chaired by Donald Rumsfeld.
There we go.
Now, Donald Rumsfeld, of course, is the guy who was also in the driving seat of Cirque when
Cirque
developed.
Yeah, Cirque, you mean.
Sorry?
Cirque.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm, incredible.
And, so, you know, Donald Rumsfeld is a, you know, has a track record here of putting pernicious pharmaceuticals into the market. But nobody wanted Tamiflu. I mean, nobody really saw any need for it. So the bird flu fear campaign was created.
Yeah.
And of course, Gilead via Roche, who had the marketing rights to Tamiflu, Rumsfeld was even able to persuade Tony Blair to spend £14 million on buying a stock of Tamiflu. and then we come on to things like Ritalin, which of course is this terrible drug. I mean, it's like cocaine.
Yeah.
It's a stimulant that seems to have the opposite effect on youth. And, you know, right now, I mean, you've got a situation where 10% of all children under the age of 16 are prescribed Ritalin in the US.
Yeah.
And the British government in 2007 spent £28 million on Ritalin.
Hmm.
I mean, this is the pharmaceutical industry effectively driving, you know, an agenda, an apparent political agenda, which of course benefits that industry.
It's a kind of a full spectrum dominance, as it is referred to. It's about
absolutely full spectrum dominance, as referred to in the PNAC document, Rebuilding America's Defences.
Is that so? I did not know that.
Yes, it is, absolutely. and of course, that particular document, which was published in September of 2000. Which is the blueprint. I mean, it's the blueprint for everything that has effectively occurred since.
Yeah.
But yeah, in that document, they actually make the reference to full spectrum dominance and list everything that that entails. The control of space, of hyperspace, you know, food. I mean, it's if you read that document without actually knowing who wrote it, you would either think it was written by sort of H.G. Wells on acid or a psychopath.
Yeah.
And of course, when you actually turn to the back page and you look at the 27 people that have put their signatures to it, you actually realize it was written by 27 psychopaths.
ten of
whom were appointed to George Bush's government the moment he was sworn in January of 2001.
It's wonderful. I mean, it's no conspiracy here. Come on.
It's not a conspiracy, it's fact.
Oh, it's incredible.
I mean, this is you know, the point I make in my talks. You know, I try and avoid as much as possible any conjecture. You know, the dots that I link together are all based on fact.
Right. You know,
but you know, the information is out there, and I absolutely, you know, understand that the vast majority of people, of course, they don't have the time, even if they have the inclination, they don't have the time to do this kind of research.
Of course.
You know, it just so happens that, you know, for the last nearly 10 years, I've had the luxury of being able to focus my energies on this research. And, you know, now, of course, you know, I try and not tell people, because you can't tell people the truth. All you can do is sow seeds and encourage people. In fact, I always say in my talks, you know, I'd be mortified if anybody took anything that I say as gospel. You know, all I'm trying to do is encourage people to actually take a look at this for themselves, because it's only when they look at it for themselves, it's only when they join the dots for themselves, that they'll realize that actually somebody is taking the piss out of the human race.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's why it's important also with, you know, supporting the work that you do. And I mean, you have the DVDs now out there, and this is a good way to kind of distill, if you will, the information, always kind of refining it to the most important high notes and key points to all of this, because as you say, people don't have much of the time, but within a lecture that you're doing in one of your DVDs, you really get to the heart of the matter, and then people can, you know, pick up on the keywords, do searches for themselves, and they're off on a, you know, incredible journey, as it were, on research, if they have the time and if they have the interest, of course.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the other point we have to make, Henrik, is that, you know, what is natural is when people sort of realize this for the first time, you know, that there is a sort of stage that they may go through, which is one of fear. But, you know, we just have to recognize that, you know, that is just an initial reaction. Because, you know, once you step through the fear, you have to ask yourself, you know, okay, you now know, you've actually seen a completely different side of government than, you know, you had before, but would you rather not know?
Yeah.
You know, and not be able to do anything about it at all? But now you know, you actually have a choice. And that choice is to say, well, actually, I'm going to bury my head in the sand, you know, because I actually rather not know. So I'm just going to carry on my life as though I never really found out anything about this at all. And then, of course, you know, you just have to accept the consequences of whatever comes about. But I believe, I mean, I fundamentally believe that these guys are doing us a massive favor. You know, they're getting very, very arrogant. They're becoming more obvious in their excesses. And they know that there's many of us who are becoming aware of their outrageous agenda. And their arrogance is such that, you know, they're taking the line that, you know, well, we know there's somebody out there who know what we're doing, but it's not enough. And we can do this stuff with impunity. And I believe that our challenge, and, it, you know, fortunately, I mean, we are an increasing number of people who are now, you know, doing this kind of investigative work, who are getting our message out there, either, you know, like you guys through radio, through me, like me, through, you know, DVDs and invitations like this to share with you over the radio. You know, but there's a number of people writing books as well, is another one, of course. There's a number of people who all got different skills, and they're all, you know, really contributing to the task, getting this information out for people to see for themselves. And it's not going to change things overnight. And I don't know, you know, when things, you know, will change, but the seeds that we're sowing today, I believe, will come to fruition when these guys least expect.
Very encouraging, and a very, you know, this is one of the interesting points that I do want to touch upon later on as well, as we dive into more about the New World Order. But in the last 8 or so remaining minutes that we have in this segment, I want to touch upon a few more things in regards to Codex here. And the first thing is, I want to talk about what I call the Codex Lady. There is one video that has been going around on Google that's called Nutricide, and this is
Nima Labo.
Exactly. And tell us a little bit about her and what you found out so far about her. That's interesting.
Yeah, she is a very interesting lady. Now, for many people, the first information that they find out about Codex is via either the Google or YouTube videos of Rima, or some of the things that she's posted on the web. And much of what she puts out is, you know, not far from being accurate. But it is my opinion that she is controlled opposition. Now, why do I say that, and what's the point of controlled opposition? Well, first and foremost, you know, I've already given an indication as to how much money is at stake in terms of the pharmaceutical industry and Big Pharma with an F, the likes of Monsanto and Cargill. These are multi-billion dollar industries, and they are looking to establish global domination. So, you know, we're not sort of pussyfooting around here. Now, the genuine players who are trying to, contain the excesses of the Codex Alimentarius Commission are the likes of the National Health Federation, which is led by a guy called Scott Tipps, who actually has compiled one of the most authoritative books on Codex, and it's called Codex Alimentarius, Global Food Imperialism. And in Europe, that's only available via my website, which is www.ianrcrane.co.uk. So Codex Alimentarius, Global Food Imperialism, written or compiled by Scott Tipps. Now, Scott works with two other people. He works with a guy called Paul Anthony Taylor, who is the external marketing director with the Dr. Rath Foundation. And he also works with the chief executive of the Alliance for Natural Health, a guy called Dr. Robert Verkirk. Now, Dr. Robert Verkirk is a really exceptional guy. And he is the scientific advisor to the National Health Federation in their challenges to Codex. Now, Paul Anthony Taylor, who is employed by the Dr. Rath Foundation, he doesn't need anybody's money because he's financed by the Dr. Rath organization. But the National Health Federation in the US and the Alliance for Natural Health in Europe are effectively charities. I mean, they are totally reliant on donations, either from companies who will be affected by Codex or from private individuals. And their money, the money that obviously they're able to pull in, goes directly to addressing the abuse of the Codex Alimentarius Commission. Mm-hmm. Rima Labo presents herself as a campaigner, but actually she has zero impact. She has no authority. She has no representation on any of the Codex committees, unlike Scott Tipps and Robert Verkirk, who are an NGO, a non-government organisation, who have observer rights and the opportunity to comment and contribute at these Codex meetings. But Rima makes a big play for money, and on her website she says that they are looking for $45,000 a month in donations to help fight Codex. Well, let me tell you, Henrik, that anybody putting money into Dr. Rima Labo's organisation, the Natural Solutions Foundation, might as well just go outside and pour it into a black hole, because it's going nowhere. And the purpose of Dr. Rima Labo and Natural Solutions Foundation, in my opinion, is to take money away, to take donations away from the likes of the Alliance for Natural Health and the National Health Federation, who can make good use of it by raising legal challenges against the excesses of Codex.
Mm-hmm.
So Rima Labo is a classic example of controlled opposition. And of course, you know, we should also mention that her partner, who's a guy called Major General Albert Stubblebine, is a PSYOP specialist.
Mm.
I mean, his entire military career was spent in psychological operations.
This is a very interesting note, and I was shocked when I saw this in your DVD. You know, he's one of the guys, of course, that was in the documentary and the subsequent also the book by the same name, The Man Who Stared at Goats. It's a kind of a...
That's exactly correct.
Yes. Yeah, it's a kind of a PSYOPs / New Age military programs that he's been involved in.
Yep.
One being the Stargate project and kind of parapsychology. And, and obviously there's nothing wrong with that, but one has to ask oneself, you know, if her husband is involved in you know, these kind of New Agey, if you will, type programs. I mean, what is the connection here? I mean, this is pretty interesting. And do you think that you know, she potentially could be, you know, involved in some way, even with a military type organization here in regards to all of this?
I mean, I have no evidence of that. You know, all I can say is that her behavior, when she turns up at various Codex committee meetings, I mean, her behavior is basically outrageous. And, I mean, she actually is disruptive towards the people who do have an opportunity to challenge the excesses of the Codex Commissions. And, I mean, yeah, here's an irony. The Codex Alimentarius Commission have recently released an official film, an official documentary. And, I mean, guess who features in it? Dr. Rima Labo.
Really?
Now, you know, why would the official film of Codex actually give airtime to somebody whose supposed mission is to shut Codex down?
Yeah.
No, I mean, listen, you know, Rima Labo's objective is to take money away, to get donations from people, you know, on the basis that she's setting herself up as this sort of person who can influence Codex, you know, and her talks, obviously, they're very emotive. But, you know, let me say to your listeners, if you are concerned about Codex Alimentarius, if you are based in the US, you must take a look at the website of the National Health Federation. These are the people who really have an opportunity to make some changes here. And if you're in Europe or elsewhere in the world, then look at the website of the Alliance for Natural Health, which is www.anhcampaign.org. You know, and these are the two organizations who I would encourage you to give your financial support to. Look at their track record. Look at the challenges they've raised. Dr. Robert Verkirk of the Alliance for Natural Health was responsible for challenging Codex in the European courts in April of 2005. And the judge, Justice Lienhardt, basically made the observation that Codex was not appropriate for European legislation because Codex, and I quote, is as transparent as a black box.
Hmm.
Now, a few months later, and by the way, there was a great film made by a producer called Kevin Miller, a director called Kevin Miller, and the film is We Become Silent.
Yeah.
And it was made very shortly after that European court ruling. And if people want to get hold of a copy of that, there is a version of it available for free on the web.
Right.
If they want a better copy, then they can, again, come to my website. But shortly after that, on July the 12th of 2005, 6 days after London was awarded the Olympics, 5 days after the London bombings, the International Court of Justice in Luxembourg overruled the European court ruling. And the reason that nobody in Britain ever heard about it was because the media here was still full of all the stuff in the immediate aftermath of the July 7th bombing. But, I mean, it was at that point that effectively the International Court of Justice ruled that the EU could no longer independently resist the implication or implementation of Codex Alimentarius.
Very interesting indeed. And by the way, I just want to mention also that I will have the links up on Red Eyes on the info page to Natural Health Federation and also Alliance for Natural Health, so people can find those websites. And of course, they can find it through your website as well, ianrcrane.co.uk. But finishing thoughts here before we end this segment here, Ian. This is a very delicate issue in regards to Rima and her other, what's it called, Natural Solutions Foundation.
Natural Solutions Foundation, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she has helped, though, to bring light to the issue, in a way.
Absolutely.
You know.
I absolutely acknowledge that. I mean, her, you know, bear in mind that her focus is absolutely, you know, external. Her focus is very much towards the public, you know, because she really doesn't have any role to play in the other direction. So there is no question, and I am, by the way, I mean, I would encourage your listeners to go take a look at her website, but go look at her website with eyes open, you know, and understand that, you know, her sole motivation is to get your money, and then that money will be used by her and Bert to travel around the world, swanning it around at the Codex meetings. The reason that, you know, people haven't heard about the work of Scott Tipps and Rob Verkerk is because obviously they're very tightly funded, and most of their money, you know, goes on raising legal and scientific challenges against Codex. You know, and obviously those are not things that are cheap.
Of course,
you know,
not.
When Rob Verkerk raised the challenge in the European Court of Justice, I mean, that was £500,000.
Yeah.
I mean, it should have been £2 million. I mean, he was very fortunate to find, you know, a law firm that was sympathetic to his campaign and was prepared to do the work at a greatly reduced rate. So, you know, Rob Verkerk and Scott Tipps, their organisations, their money is going into legal and scientific challenges. Rima Labo's money goes into first-class airfares.
Well, it's a very important point, and as I said, it's encouraged to check out all the different sides on the issue and check out what rings true for yourself when you look at all of this.
Exactly.
But it's a very good point, Ian, and I think it's appropriate to begin to round things up on that note. And I want to, you know, before we begin with our next segment, though, I want to leave the floor open so you can mention your websites again, and also, of course, you have a DVD out on the subject of Codex Alimentarius, and tell us how people can get that DVD in case they're interested.
Yeah, the DVD is called the Codex Alimentarius, the UN agenda to eradicate organic farming and to destroy the complementary and natural health industry. Big mouthful, just call it Codex Alimentarius.
Right.
It's available from my website, which is www.ianrcrane, that's ianrcrane.co.uk.
Very good. And what we are going to do now is that we're going to take a short break right here. We have a lot more to talk about. I definitely want to get into Ian's take on the New World Order and also how this connects with Scion. We're going to talk a little bit more about 2012 and a lot of the surrounding issues and how all of this might be connected in a way. This is very interesting. So what we'll do is that we'll take a short break and we'll have more of Ian after this break. So for this segment, thank you very much, Ian, for joining us. It was great having you on. But stay with us and we'll be right back.
Thank you, Henrik.
Thank you very much for joining us. If you want to hear more of Ian and myself as we'll dive into the agenda of the New World Order, Scion, and how this connects with what they consider to be a key date, 2012, the year of mystery, join us in our member section as we'll talk more about this and much, much more. Head on over to redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. And at the front page or through our radio archive, click on subscribe to find out how to sign up and get instant access to our member section. You'll get full access to our radio archive, and in our member section you'll also find film material, articles, our first archived live video broadcast, and we have a lot more video content coming soon. Interviews that we did recently at the Beyond Knowledge Conference and our tour of London. So if you're interested, much more information is available at redicecreations.com. I also want to mention that our forum will be up and running May the 24th. We've created an entirely new website for this, so take a look at rediceforum.com, rediceforum.com. Under info and rules, you can read more about how to join the open forum. This is Henrik Palmgren. My thanks to producer Fredrik and to you for listening. We'll be right back with more Ian Crane after our break.